Hello, world. It's Mike Traverso with the Friends That Code podcast, where I get a chance to showcase some amazing people I know that just happen to write code for a living. Folks, today I'm very excited to make the acquaintance of and speak with today's guest. He most certainly will not disappoint. If ever someone embodies a Renaissance person, it's today's guest. After going through the traditional route of getting a computer science degree, today's guest has started numerous startups, focusing on politics online before it became 2020 crazy, to working with wearable technology, helping people get in shape and stay healthy, something we all could be doing now, being stuck inside. Running or working with as many startups as today's guest has, he's accumulated a lot of experience in managing both projects and products. He's taken that experience and helped share some of that knowledge as a Google developer expert in product strategy. Today's guest is a captivating speaker. Through his talks, he's helped open a lot of minds, whether it's helping us understand how face-based AR systems should behave in our society, to helping us understand how to manage our products in the age of the increasingly importance placed on data privacy. In addition to giving talks on some fascinating topics, he's a product manager by trade, but also continues to write code. But here's the thing. He's not content to just sit by and relax on his laurels. No, today's guest has completed numerous Udacity Nano degrees, which are tough boot camps packed with learning and projects intended to transfer a plethora of knowledge to the students in a virtual environment. His most recent Nano degree completion was in AI product management. But it's not just the Nano degrees. He studies on his own. Most impressive, I'm serious, was his talk last year on data privacy, where he learned Flutter and Firebase to create an app just to demonstrate the principles in his talk. But most of us that give talks just find a funny GIF or a meme to include in our slides and we move on. That's it. Folks, former Google developer expert, senior product manager, product strategist, certified sprint master, certified Safe 5, VR and AR developer, holder of numerous Udacity Nano degrees, Renaissance man, incredibly talented, and yes, you did once see him in that Chevy commercial. Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest is Noble Ackerson. Noble, thanks for joining us today. How are you doing?
Thank you for that awesome introduction. I'm honored to be here and thanks for the chat.
Oh, it's my pleasure to have you on. And I just hope that I'm able to share your story with a bunch of folks because it is very interesting. And I want to get going right away with some of the stuff that you've done. And let's put it this, one of my lifelong dreams, now part-time hobby, is to be a game developer. I suspect it was one of the reasons that you went through the Udacity Virtual Reality Nano degree program for that same reason. But working through that program, one of your assignments was to create a game consisting of different puzzles. And you have this great story behind what inspired you to create that game. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yes, great question. So first, I have just this rabid obsession with the next computing medium, which I believe is extended reality. Some people call it mixed reality. Some people call it spatial computing. We've gone from, you know, punch cards to the mouse and keyboard. And I truly believe that untangling ourselves from the mouse and keyboard and our phone and taps with our phone and just providing ambient information when I need it and just so I'm not sort of tethered to a handheld device could possibly be the way of the future. And I've had this belief for over a decade. And so when it came to how I could upskill myself as far as my technical aptitude, I decided to jump into C-sharp and try to learn a bit about VR development using Unity. I was able to get far, but not far enough. And so I signed up for Udacity and their beta program at the time. At the time, I'd had a few Udacity Nano degrees under my belt, front-end developer Nano degree and all that stuff. And so, yeah, I believe that as a product manager by trade, I have a very strong belief that I should be able to understand enough about the technical bits as to what a product is doing so that I can explain why it's important to go in a specific direction, you know, what we're doing, and at least speak the language to the audience or the technical audience that I serve, right? Same thing with design. But specifically about the VR game that I built, it was a simple puzzle game just to show, you know, the concepts of game development. And I turned that into this is Black History Month, and so I'm sure it's very topical, a way to teach younger people about African history. I'm a dad. I've got a daughter that doesn't really, you know, have a way to sort of, you know, sit down for more than 5 minutes. She has an attention span of a newt. And so when I was growing up, like many cultures, it was storytelling. My grandfather would sit me down and tell me this crazy story, and I'd be like, wow, I know that my generation dealt with that. And also my generation dealt with, you know, learning about stuff on Wikipedia and on the internet generally. But then my interest in VR and AR steps in where I start thinking, what would be so cool for my kid to actually be immersed in a game, an educational game, and have her learn. So what I did with that puzzle is, as you unlock you solve a puzzle, the protagonist in the game, which I should mention is a queen called a queen mother. They called her Ya Asantewaa. She was the queen of the Ashantis, who basically had an empire in most of West Africa, basically all of West Africa, rather, so the western part of and sub-Saharan Africa. And what she did was try to fight off the British from pillaging and over trading and what she thought was running their resources dry. And so as they came, you know, there were some artifacts that she didn't want to sell, but some chieftains would have promised it. And so she would fight off the thing. So you don't see the protagonist because you're the protagonist in this scenario. And as you go through caves and stuff like that, you unlocked different facts about African history or West African history.
Yeah. And I didn't play the game, but I saw a lot of the videos that you posted online. And then I went back in and tried to understand the story by following through. You know, I went down the YouTube rabbit hole and tried to understand like what is the story behind this? You know, what's inspiring this? And it fascinating story. And the protagonist here is such a strong character. This is a really cool story to learn. You should know it. And the game is so kind of is really cool. I'm a big fan of puzzler games. My first game was a puzzler game. So, was this your first game though?
That was technically, yes. It's before the Udacity Nano degree, I try to, like I said before, teach myself. And I used something called Le Dumb Dare. It's basically like a hackathon that happens by game developers. And I sort of jumped in and decided to submit, you know, a very rough version of what I was trying to do using tutorials and stuff like that. So, and then of course I polished it a little bit during Udacity. And then later I tried to extend it to support AR and Google Home Assistant or Google Home.
That's cool. That's cool. I, you know, doing anything in 3D is very complicated. So yeah. I didn't even try that. Like all of my games are 2D, but I'm inspired now to really try and get into 3D because you really walk through kind of, you know, even with the asset creation and just kind of, hey, I'm going to go to an asset store and buy some of these assets. So yeah, that I can't imagine like the undertaking because to go from zero to 3D game, that's pretty impressive. I'd love to see this kind of really get a full treatment because I think the story is really fascinating. And it's just kind of a cool game to play. And, you know, I know Google VR is kind of, you know, doing a certain thing. I'm not going to bring that up, but what I will bring up is that in addition to this VR project, you've also been a fan of Google Glass.
That's right.
Obviously. So, and so much so that you almost got thrown off of a flight once for wearing it.
Yeah, it's nuts. at the time, you know, I was full bore. I started a community, one of the, if not the largest glass community with a couple friends of mine. Before the device launched, I was invited to participate in the first Google Glass hackathon in New York. And I got hands-on with the device before it was public, through NDAs and all that stuff. And so, yeah, I drank the Kool-Aid. What can I say? It really, cemented my interest in the next computing medium, as I described before, and so I quit my job, you know, wanted to build a fitness startup that was augmented by an assistant, a virtual fitness assistant. And so as part of that, I needed to demo and do a lot of talks, and I chose a route and not go stealth, and just because it was an emerging technology, I wanted to share the idea. And on one such trip, check in to the airport. I go through the gates and get to the airplane.
I imagine the whole time getting crazy looks.
Crazy looks. Crazy looks.
Curious looks.
Curious looks is like, what is that device? At this point in time, Glass had launched, so it wasn't that weird, you know, but people felt uncomfortable with it, it turns out. But I'll get to that point in a second. I check my bags, and as I'm sitting down, the flight attendant walks up to me and says, please take off your device. Mind you, my device was also my prescription, so I was wearing the version that had the you know,
it's full glasses,
prescription lenses. And I try to explain that to her, and I asked why, and she goes, oh, well, you know, there's a passenger, a couple passengers, I can't remember the exact details, that were uncomfortable with me wearing the device.
That's crazy.
I couldn't really argue, cause I'd get thrown off. Someone on the plane, or some people on the plane, were concerned about me recording them on a tiny face computer, but had gone through all the surveillance and security checks and all the cameras in a typical airport. And I found that hilarious. And that event sort of sparked a series of other events, like an awareness about why that was the case and what why people didn't trust, say, Google making surveillance or a face computer with a camera accessible to everyone versus a government CCTV recording everyone, but we're all okay with it.
And I think they kind of just missed the mark on this, because I think selfie sticks became popular in 2014. Mm-hmm. So I think if this would have come out after selfie sticks, where the dawn of the YouTube generation kind of started, mm-hmm. I think then Google Glass would have been a little bit more acceptable. And for example, there's been rumors of Apple creating an AR device into their product line. So now, having been through Glass, are you ready to jump into another expensive AR VR device?
The rumored Apple device, I read somewhere, could be as much as $8,000. So it may not be targeted at me. I don't know whether I'd probably get kicked out of the house. That's like, that's expensive. But you know, we'll find out where it comes to. So right now my resistance would be cost, but I'd be actually very interested in developing for it, or at least, helping, put together, guidelines, around how to protect, you know, people's privacy with it, whether or not it has a camera. It should have a camera, because it is going to be, an inside out tracking devices. Most AR devices are today, and even VR devices are today. And so it will be a great opportunity to learn about this future of computing, as I keep mentioning.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, and speaking of Apple, you know, Tim Cook recently has been coming out strong against Facebook. Obviously not against, you know, not over their VR, but in particular how they treat user data. And you talked a bit about data privacy, and you've worked with that in data trust. You've given talks on the topics. You know, why is data privacy and data trust so important?
Well, in order to answer that, I would have to define data privacy, and then and then I can tell you why data trust is important, right? So privacy, in my view, is not about security. It's not about encryption. It's about three things. It's about context, choice, and control. For context, you need to understand why the data is being collected. Companies need to be a little bit more transparent about what is being collected, who's being shared with. Once they are transparent about that, provide me enough context, I should be able to opt in or opt out to what I'd like collected. As Tim Cook has been saying, you know, over and over again, that and even the EU with their regulation, privacy, data privacy is a fundamental human right. And I'm a fundamentalist from that perspective. And then the third is control. So you've given me the choice to act upon my my preferences. And so, you know, should things change? If I gave you permission to use my data for your ads or for some good that benefits me, I should be able to delete that data at any point. And so the whole, that to me, context, control, and choice sum up what data privacy means to me. Now, onto data trust. If you are transparent, you provide the agency for any human to act on what they need to collect from you, because again, it's not your, the company's data, it is a human's data. And you give them accessible ways to control their data that you use to provide you, the company, value, you are afforded trust over time. And the market will reward or punish a company based on that trust. And again, this is constrained to data. And I formally define data trust as a sum of the transparency that any company provides me, plus the value that I perceive to be delivered. Am I getting value from this widget or software or thing, plus an acceptance of the consequences that might happen, which in my opinion is inevitable because anything on the internet is susceptible to a breach. If there is a breach with my app, and I feel that the company is transparent enough with where the data was kept, what happened, you know, how long they store the data, and what they're doing to rectify that situation, and I still have a perceived level of value delivered from that service, then I trust that my data is safe. And that's how I define data trust. And that's why I think it's important. And that also goes back to that Google flight attendant almost getting kicked out of the plane story, because at that moment that I was just scratching my head, wondering why, you know, this, I knew why the face computer was made people uncomfortable, but then why it was okay for, you know, someone to go through the gauntlet of cameras in an airport. I realized then that it really wasn't that someone was uncomfortable with me. I feel that folks weren't comfortable with Google as a company because they didn't have any context as to what was happening with the data that would be collected if I was, I wasn't, by the way, recording. They had no choice or agency to, say, blur my face, nor did they have any way to control, you know, some random repository of photos taking of it. People are so self-important, me included. So that basically was the sort of just eureka moment at that moment. That's why I started working on data privacy.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, for in that particular example, it's after 2013, because that's when Glass comes out. And, you know, at this point, iPhones have been out for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Not only do they have copy and paste at this point, right? But they've also got video. They've got cameras. You no longer do you have someone having walking around with a giant camcorder that you can notice, but they've got those, you know, these little phones that or these little computers that can also take photos and do whatever they want with. So it's kind of weird that because yours was on your face, if only that part could have been stashed away, it probably would have been okay.
You know what's funny about what you just said? The punchline of the story, as I tell it, is that as I was having that exchange with the flight attendant, explaining away why I couldn't possibly be recording, everyone around me had their phones out recording the situation.
Yeah, that makes sense. It was probably the people who complained as well. Exactly. Like it doesn't register. And that's why folks never fly Southwest. I will edit that out. Okay. But seriously though, there is some apprehension, like you just said, because these devices or a lot of the data, it's coming from devices or social media networks that are run by some of the world's largest advertising and retail businesses. So there is a need to worry, but like Noble's saying, if they're honest and upfront about how your data is being used and you have agency on how you can delete it or modify it or change it or take some of it away and, or add more, whatever, then at least there's some, you feel a little bit safer. It's just knowing, you know, being made aware of it as opposed to being left in the dark. Noble, I got a quick question for all of the folks out there who are looking to start up their next new app, you know, their next new social media network, where they want to be able to measure some analytics of some of their users so that they can better sell them some more products. Do they need to worry about GDPR and/or CCPA?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Because those are regulations that you have to adhere to. If you are fortunate enough to be successful and you didn't plan for data privacy, you're doing two things. One, you're putting your business at risk and your stakeholders and your fiduciaries at risk because in the EU, that's about 8%. Of your annual revenue. And as a startup, that's a death nail. You're dead. You're gone. For Google or for Apple, you know, yeah, they just bat that away and just get some pocket change and pay that off. But, you know, 20 million euros, no. So whichever comes first, I think that's the rule with GDPR. CCPA, again, same thing. There's some teeth, not as much as the GDPR. So that's one thing. The second thing is, because it's a regulation, if you want to do business as a social media company in those countries, you're kind of restricting yourself from a geographic standpoint, because you have to adhere. You have to have a DPO, a data processing officer, that is registered with an office in the country that you're working in, or the country whose customers you're serving in the EU. So it's almost the legal guys call it a long arm jurisdiction. Doesn't matter if you're in the EU or not, you have to be adherent to it.
Yeah, and I think that's cool. And I don't want to discourage folks from getting into making apps, but I do want them to understand that they should be thinking about this and have a plan for it if they are successful, so that what can they do down the road?
Let's do this. Let me add one quick thing.
Sure.
For the startups and for the individual developers, people who have a great idea looking to put it out there, don't look at it as, you know, a compliance check that you have to make and think of, you certainly have to think about that and not put yourself at risk from a financial standpoint or from a regulation standpoint. But think about, you know, what happens to one of your users or a segment of your users that may suffer in the event of a breach that may happen to either you, the developer or a company, or your processor, or, you know, the person, you know, or even the people who, you know, your partner, AWS, yeah, what have you, happened with Capital One recently. Like, so think about that. And so you start thinking about things like data minimization and zero trust, those kind of things in order to provide, believe it or not, a superior user experience for your user.
Yeah, and that becomes a feature.
Exactly. Well,
because you can say, hey, come onto our platform, come onto our app, because we don't do this, and here's what we do use, and if you don't want us to use it, you know, take it away. Cool. All right, so Noble, doing some research into your background, and you have a computer science degree, but you also hold, like I said, we were talking about this before, you hold a few different nano degrees from Udacity. It's obvious, I think, to anybody that's listening at this point that you love learning. I mean, and then not only that, but then you've contributed to Google Glass. You've built some apps with Firebase and Flutter. You've worked on virtual reality apps and games in Unity, we talked about. And you've been a product manager as well. And recently, you've completed your certification in AI product management, Udacity. And I promise, folks, this isn't an ad for Udacity. They're not sponsoring this. But here's my question. You've gone the alternative route of continuing education. What's been so appealing to you about the Udacity platform, or just, you know, that way that you've gone with, I guess, as opposed to the more, say, traditional route of continuing education, which is going back and getting a master's degree?
A couple of things. One is cost. Udacity is not the cheapest route for most people, and you know, you have alternatives, free alternatives. You've got, you know, lower cost alternatives like Udemy, Coursera, and other services. But for the value and the breadth of services that you get with the Udacity platform, I thought, and I still think, that it's a superior learning MOOC, if that's still a term. So Udacity provides like counseling and career
mentorship
and all that stuff. I happen to have been a mentor as well and a coach at Udacity because they just said, this guy won't leave, so let's just put him to work. And just, I love helping people. And it just became a familiar thing for me. I should disclose again, like you said, it's not an ad for Udacity. They do not pay me. I do also use Coursera for more advanced topics. The self-learning or sort of the self-paced learning is something that I enjoy. So I won't pay for, you know, to go back. I'm not a professional student in that sense, where I'm back to school. You know, I'm a little older. I've got responsibilities. I've got a family, and I like the flexibility of the self-paced rather than a regular academic institution.
Excellent. The way you've gone about it, I think, is something, it's inspiring to someone like me who, you know, I'm on the fence. Do I go back and get a master's degree? You know, when I was working on Wall Street, everybody I knew was going back and getting their MBAs or, going for their CFAs. And you kind of feel like, well, should I do that? I'm not really that interested in it. I don't want to. I don't want to get a master's degree in computer science, but to pick out all these different topics that I might be interested in and spend what's not an insignificant amount of money, but it's much, much more affordable than even going to a state school where the tuition may be lower and going through a two-year graduate course or a year and a half graduate course. So you've gone through it a number of times now. What is the best advice you could give to someone who may be thinking about continuing their education before they commit their time and their money? What's something you wish you knew when you started that?
Well, I would advise that if you're really thinking about it, that you define what success looks like for you. Are you looking to just get a promotion at work? Are you looking to get a new job? Is it worth the investment for that goal, that success measure? So that's your first start. And then a second piece of advice from that is there's never enough time for anybody. You can always fill a vacuum with stuff to do. But ask yourself, am I really prepared to invest the time in order to get to the finish line with this thing? Now, even if the answer is I don't have time because I have kids, I've got someone, a family member to take care of, I work too much, that is a solvable problem. So the third advice is regarding making time is manage the projects that you have to do by breaking up those deliverables, call them, or your submissions into small, sizable chunks. So if you think you can invest 4 hours a week, a work week to it, you can sort of just work backwards from that and say, well, 30 minutes during my lunch as I'm munching on whatever, I can, you know, knock out this part or continue reading or consuming this portion of the course. But then use some, and then there's a fourth piece of advice. If two and three fail, the fourth advice is try to find a trigger, something that will break you into wanting to just open up the book or turning on the course on your computer to start learning. And if you do that enough times, you'll start getting into a routine. If you do that enough time, there's a feedback loop that will bring you back to that trigger. It's like, well, I felt this way once I marched all the way painfully towards this submission. I submitted it. Maybe I didn't pass and I had to do it again. But that's still that euphoric, that endorphin that gets released. That's the reward center. And this hopefully feeds that trigger again.
That's excellent advice. As a matter of fact, when we post this show, I'm going to put all of that stuff in each one of them in tweets. Nice. Or you should put that in tweets.
I will retweet it. See, I don't have time. I'm just kidding.
Right. Well, it's that. See, when you say it kind of makes sense, though. When you say you don't have time, it makes sense. And here's why. You've mentored, like you said, other nano degree students. You've mentored hackathons. I know you've been a GDE before, and I know what's involved there. We've spoken to a bunch of other GDEs on the show. So I know you've given lots of talks at conferences, and you're an educator almost, so to speak. Or mentor. I don't know what the right word would be, but what has been the most educational experience that you've had from teaching?
Oh, wow. I can answer it this way. So I don't know who coined this. I claim it's me, so I'll take credit for it. But I learn by teaching, and I teach so that I can learn. And that feeds me learning more, if that makes any sense. I didn't say it right, but that hopefully makes sense. But, I just gain more knowledge, especially because I'd never embark in an area that I don't have interest in. I guess that's the nugget for me, is that if I don't have any interest in, I was a terrible student, in traditional, at school. And I realize now introspectively that it may have been because I just had no interest in those subjects. I respect the foundations of computing, but sitting in an assembly class for hours is
not fun.
Not fun at all. And so with the internet, I'm able to sort of just hone in on an area. And the more I I feed my hunger or my thirst for knowledge in an area that I'm interested in, the more confident I am to speak on the subject. And once I know it well, I'm able to teach others, and it just keeps cycling, looping.
I love that you've said, you know, the best way to learn is to teach.
Right.
I've said that in a couple of my talks, and I spoke with Nate Ebel about it, because his big thing was about teaching, and he loves to teach. And
yeah,
you know, I think that was the title of his podcast, is teaching is the best way to learn. So it really is. And you do get this high from teaching. Once you see someone gets what you're trying to convey, you realize that you've just somehow, through language, you've conveyed something that was in your brain to someone else. And when you see that happen and you see the lights go, oh wow. And they get it. It's like a little bit of a high. So yeah, I teach not just for that, but just for the buzz that you get out of it. Just because I'm very selfish like that. I mentioned you give a lot of talks, conferences, you've contributed to government panels, to the UN, I think at one point. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
Okay. Excellent. So when life gets back to normal, which conference are you most looking forward to? Yeah, no pressure.
Oh boy. So one of the last two major conferences that I spoke at before the lockdown due to the pandemic were Refactor Tech and Abstractions. Refactor Tech is in Atlanta. They focus on minorities in tech. So minority being, gender, race, what have you. And it was the most diverse, the most phenomenal talk. I actually had more time sitting in on other people's panels, learning about how they built their own pacemakers. Like the topics were just phenomenal. And then Abstractions was in Pittsburgh, I believe. And that's also, I was just flawed to be invited to speak. And I recommend that to anyone who's looking for conferences. So to answer your question, those two would be first on the list.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to put links to Abstractions and Refactor Tech in the show notes, so folks can check them out, just to keep, find them on Twitter and kind of keep up to date just to see what they're doing. Because maybe they don't do in person this year, but I know they'll probably be doing a virtual conference as well. And I'm definitely going to get it on Refactor Tech. I didn't find that until it was on Twitter, and I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Noble, I'd like to ask you some questions and ask you to look back on your career a bit, if that's okay with you.
Sure thing.
Excellent. Okay. What have been some of the challenges that you've struggled with coming up as either a developer, an entrepreneur, or product manager?
Challenges. This is a really good question. So I would say that for me, personally, is not realizing until my late 20s, early 30s, that I wasn't constrained by, what I could actually learn, what I could actually do. One of my very first Medium posts was about the art of self. What was the title? It was like the art of self reinvention. And that was a result of me just coming to terms that, I didn't have to be stuck. Up until that moment, that was certainly, it was a challenge that I didn't even realize I had. That was the first one. The second challenge was as a startup founder, not really having the resources, the connections, and the reach that other startup founders in my cohort when I did my accelerator had in order to, you know, meet. I always tell people when I'm talking to startup founders who are Black and brown that, you know, I would get asked things like, yeah, this is a pre-seed round. You're not really VC ready. Go raise a friends and family round. And I just bust out laughing, thinking, you know, you may have a privileged individual. I may not say this to their face, but say a privileged individual may have a friend or family that can raise, you know, $250 here, or, you know, $25,000 yeah. there. But for me, I didn't have that. But, you know, that's actually why I joined the accelerator, in order to broaden my horizons.
Yeah, that's great advice to give someone who's a startup founder, is to go raise money. Like, that's why I'm here talking to you.
Right.
If I had the money, I wouldn't be talking.
Exactly.
startups.
First time, last time, I think.
Yeah.
Or second time, but third time, last time. I don't know.
Okay. Have you encountered imposter syndrome or feelings of being a fraud in your career? And if so, how have you dealt with those feelings?
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure we all do at some point or another. I actually have mentees at Ventera, a company that I work with, and that, you know, who talk about this all the time. And because I'm a continuous learner, I'm very transparent that I don't have the answers. And as a product leader, I think, or I like to believe, that by showing that vulnerability, that I don't have the answers, I'm figuring it out just like you are, even if you're an associate developer or intern. You have a voice, you have a perspective that I may not have. So I turn my imposter syndrome into a leadership trait. It's a cheating way to do it, but I get asked a question, or I'm accomplishing something that I don't know whether it's the right way to do it. And if, you know, I'm asked to justify a path, I open it up. I go the human-centered route and say, well, what would you do? And I hear them out, because one, it helps me learn a different perspective. Maybe I was just trapped in my own mind. And I think that's what's at the moment would be contributing to my imposter syndrome.
Very good. Very good. Very good advice. There is, you know, so the way that you go about just your life in general, where you're constantly learning, is a great way to not feel like a fraud as much. Because when you're constantly learning something, you know, you kind of have this one, you have this attitude of, I don't know these things, and I'm going to try to learn these things. And that's a really cool way to go about life, right? Like, I'm just going to learn a lot of things. So you don't stay stale. So that's right there is one, that you are staying up to date, or you are, you know, just learning things and having a good time. So that is one great way to do it. And I think the other thing that you mentioned is just admitting that you are feeling that way. And that's something else. I try to equate it to like hunger. You know, if you know that you're hungry, you go and make a sandwich or get a snack. If you feel like you've got imposter syndrome, or you feel that anxiety building up, that's when you can take steps to alleviate it. So maybe for you, it's kind of taking a break, walking away, getting some, you know, mental decompression, and then coming back at it. Or maybe it's talking to somebody and finding a different way to look at it. But yeah, I mean, that those are two great ways that you mentioned that you practice, that are great ways to combat imposter syndrome. So
yeah,
kudos on that.
That's awesome. There's a Japanese, or there's a Aikido, which is a martial art phrase called shu ha ri, right? And it's, if I remember correctly, it's just a way to describe the progression of training and or learning. And shuhari is basically the shu part is just adhering to tradition, what the standards are. The ha is innovation based on those foundations that you've gained. And the re is to transcend. And so whenever I'm feeling in some imposter syndrome, I'm unsure about myself, I always have the shu. I always have that base, that foundation to go to as a crutch. You know, do I really, if I can't explain, it goes back to the whole teaching thing. That should have been my answer to that question. If I can't explain this to an expert, I gave a talk at NASA, at Johnson Space Center, to astronauts that
That's
are
cool.
flying rockets into space. It's one of my most, don't go looking for that video, please. It's chock full of ahs and ums. But if I can only transcend, I can only be confident enough to explain something in a perspective that someone who knows the subject cold, and I'm successful only if I get a, huh, I never thought about this. I knew this in concept at the shu or even the ha, but I hadn't really transcended and understood this in a way that you are saying. So I'm now fortified a little bit with my adherence to the foundations of that concept. So that's another way to sort of blend those two questions. Yeah.
That's awesome. I love that answer. As a matter of fact, I think that answer wins just the question. Noble, what is something you wish you knew when you were younger?
I wish I knew that I would be trapped in a home for, you know, a year, maybe more, you know, due to a pandemic. I wish I knew how fragile the internet can be. Any new tool that is created can be used for good and for evil. And when I was younger, as I am today, I'm sure you talked about Google Glass, I only saw emergent things, whether it was a technology or not, as if it was cool enough for me in my eyes, only as the positives. Oh, wow, I can send text and in an instant, someone else that is not next to me sees it. Email, that is amazing. I'm signing up for GeoCities, whatever it is. So that was basically the sort of the thought. Always looking at things, just technology and emerging tech, very, you know, sunshine and poppy seeds, kind of just very, very positive, a glass half full. And as an adult, we talked about data privacy. We can see how dangerous the use of the tool can be if it isn't governed, self-governed, or governed through the help of the people we put in power. I'm not saying one or the other exclusively. And enable others to push all of us, elected officials and companies, you know, stakeholders to do better with that tool.
Excellent answer. Excellent answer. We'll take it down a little bit from there and do something fun. What do you do to escape and clear your mind from work?
Right now, it's my kids. Okay. I can't escape outside the four walls.
You can't escape your kids.
Well, I can't escape them either. I can't escape because we're in a pandemic. So, you know, right. If it means, you know, just detaching and going there, I escape also through just learning. I know I've mentioned that before, but building or trying out new technologies or pushing, you know, code to my limits, which isn't that high. But there goes my imposter syndrome again. That's sort of my escape, trying to do things that are not work-related or fitness. Fitness would be the third, yeah.
Well, you also mentioned that you're working on a new app. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Are you working on it? Are you working on a new app? Excellent.
I am.
Perfect. Tell me about this new app. What are you building?
So As a vehicle owner, you get signals, whether you need an oil change, a visual reminder, when the inspection is due, you know, you get the little sticker on your windshield, all that stuff. Unfortunately, for a homeowner, there is no such notification service. There's no such alert that something in your house that is degrading will cost you a lot of money. It will decrease the value of your home, maybe, if you're talking about like the roof or the HVAC, you know, or even make you less safe if you do not tend to it. Homeowners tend to, at least the ones that I've researched and surveyed, I sent out a bunch of, I paid Twitter for surveys and used different services to understand this problem better. We largely don't have the time to have any inferences on what could happen. And so there are a couple paths that homeowners would take. They will either, if they have the means, they will pay for a service provider to check in, a subscription to come check in and fix your, check up on your plumbing, your heating, your what have you, periodically. And hopefully you're safe and your the value of your things are sustained. Or you can use a notepad or a tool, Trello, calendar, in order to remind yourself, you know, when you think things are gonna. So that's the problem. I built a tool that was aimed at reducing the friction of manual entry, which is a problem for Trello users or task management tools, notepad, you know, sticky notes get, you know, faded over time, because these things that go bad over time aren't things that go bad often. So this app that I built will eventually be a free AI machine learning driven service for homeowners looking for peace of mind without the maintenance, without worrying about the maintenance of home improvement responsibilities. And they hopefully will leverage this tool to have my app securely send timely, relevant, and contextual conversations to you when you are when we feel things are bad. Now, so the next question is like that sounds like magic. How does that happen? So the only signals that I'm listening for are make, model of the thing. If it's a roof or an external item, you know, when it was installed. So that's the second signal. You know, when it was last maintained. Weather conditions, didn't see that coming. So weather conditions. And the reason for weather data is that, you know, if you have a hotter than normal season, right? And this is where the machine learning modeling stuff comes out. If there's a warmer than normal summer in a specific region, this app will model weights probability of sort of needing a service earlier than a year of a standard HVAC or furnace, right? And the delta will be just basically the threshold. You know, I'm predicting that you need a service within this time because you'll get this performance increase by X. And I have the inference says I have this level of confidence. And so send a notification to the user for that. So what I have on my GitHub page is the beginnings of that. Right now, it is very simple Flutter Firebase app. Doesn't have all the magic stuff yet because we have the it's in public beta right now. And the link is on my GitHub page, open source. But what I'm trying to do is just to understand if at least the baseline features are enough to solve the problem. And then we will add additional value add features to eliminate that friction through more advanced means.
Very cool. Yeah, I mean, as you were going through some of the symptoms, I was like, oh, I should probably check on some.
I swear, I lost the sump pump. So I'm a second time homeowner. And I only realized that what a sump pump was after I noticed my basement flooded. And it hadn't been replaced since 2001 when it was installed. So, you know, I had to fix the drywall, get pay for the drywall to be fixed, you know, replace carpets and padding, get the whole place repainted and replace the sump pump. And I wish I had, you know, Trello or I keep talking about Trello. I love Trello, but it's the only to-do app that I use. But, you know, a tool like that, I would need to do a lot of work to remind me that I need to take an action or something.
Right. Excellent. Does the app have a name yet?
It doesn't. It's going by Home Service Scheduler or Home Assistant Reminder System. It's a terrible name. And
you need to take out a lot of the vowels
immediately. Exactly. I don't really care about the name right now. The branding, I'm taking a different path. That will be a survey to the users someday if it is actually serving a need. And I, you know, there's a whole business model ideas that I'm thinking about and maybe it'll come.
I think this is a great idea. I think a lot of people would find this useful. Yeah. Excellent idea. I got one last question for you, Noble. I know we're running out of time, but this is a good one. Folks in our professions, we don't get a lot of time or opportunities to promote ourselves. So without being modest, what are you most proud about yourself?
I'm proud that I had no experience with Dart, Flutter, and some limited experience with Firebase, and was able to churn out this app so that I could actually give a talk about it at Android Summit. What am I proud about really is along those lines is, you know, being fortunate enough to understand subjects through a lot of hard work and be offered the platform like you, Mike, to share my story. And so with that, I should leave it there. Before I leave it there, I'm also fortunate enough. I'm proud. I just want to leave a little plug for an organization that I'm part of called the Black Code Collective. Two plugs. The Black Code Collective, which is a collective of Black engineers that come together to share some of these similar stories, and founded by a young lady that inspires me every day. Second is an organization that I'm also part of in the AR, Open AR Cloud, and XRSI, which is Extended Reality Safety Initiative, that I contribute to in order to tackle some of these really hard data privacy, safety, and trust issues as well.
Perfect. Excellent. I will put links to both of those organizations in the show notes. And we'll kind of give a little bit about their Twitter. We'll give their Twitter handles in there as well, so you can follow them on Twitter. So, Noble, I hope you had some fun hanging out today.
I had a blast. This is
excellent.
I didn't have a chance to pre-read the questions or get a sense of direction. I was super busy, but I think we did pretty well winging it.
Yeah. You know, a lot of folks don't realize this, but I do send out questions to the guests because I don't want to blindside them. I mean, this is not some kind of Dateline news where I'm trying to trap a guest. You know, this is a loose conversation between two people in technology, and we're trying to find nuggets of wisdom somehow between two people over the course of an hour. So I think we did that. So, you know, virtual high five, man. for folks out there that are interested in hearing more from Noble, you can follow him on Twitter at Noble Ackerson. He has his own YouTube channel as well with recorded talks that I strongly encourage folks to go check out, especially if you're interested in data privacy or VR, AR. He also has a really cool webpage link. It's called Noble's nobles.page. I love that URL, nobles.page. And links to everything we talked about will be mentioned that we mentioned here will be put in the show notes, so you can check those out as well. Twitter handles, links, all that. Noble, thanks again, and thank you all for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and if you're interested, you know, I'd love to hear back from you. You can email me at hello@friendsthatcode.com. I'd love to hear some constructive criticism, or just tell me what guests you'd like to hear from in the future. And with that, tell your friends, because next week we'll be back again with another amazing person that I know that just happens to write code for a living. Until then, be well, everyone.